with that, let's call the meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. Monday, February 18th. Senator Bishop is here, Senator Reinbold is here, Senator Kawasaki is here, and myself, Chairman Birch. I would note that Senator Giesel may be joining us a little later. Do we have any legislators in the audience? I see none. Please silence your cell phones or put them on vibrate or such. We only have one item on today's agenda. It's a presentation entitled Oil and Mining Solutions at the University of Alaska. As we all know, Alaska holds tremendous potential for oil, gas, and minerals development. USGS estimates the potential for nearly 40 billion barrels of oil and over 200 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in Arctic Alaska. And the Department of Commerce reports that Alaska is ranked as one of the top 15 locations in the world for known resources of important minerals like zinc, silver, gold, copper, and rare earth metals. But in order to develop these resources and maximize benefits to the state and to our economy, we'll have to overcome technical obstacles to development and we'll need a skilled workforce. Here today to show us how our university system is working to do both is Dr. William Schnabel, Dean of the UAF College of Engineering and Mines. Dr. Schnabel, welcome. Please put your name on the record and welcome to our Senate Resources Committee this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name, for the record, is William Schnabel. I am the Dean of the College of Engineering and Mines at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I appreciate the invitation from you and the committee members to be here today. This is fabulous. Thank you very much. So. Okay.
Got a presentation in front of us here, and then do you care if we take questions as we go, or
absolutely not. Yes, feel free to stop me at any point and ask questions. That's what for primarily this is an informative session, so I'm here to kind of inform.
Perfect. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I have been associated with the University of Alaska for many years. I got my PhD actually in Fairbanks at UAF. I worked at University of Alaska Anchorage, taught down there, and did research there for about 5 years in the early 2000s. I worked in private industry for a while and then came up to University of Alaska Fairbanks in 2007. And I've been a faculty member there and a researcher, taught there, worked as the director for the Institute of Northern Engineering at UAF for several years, and just recently, just last month, as a matter of fact, became the dean of the College of Engineering and Mines. And my job there is to kind of oversee the college and look after the education mission of our college, as well as kind of keep tabs on the research mission. And so with respect to our mission, in general, the University of Alaska has three primary missions. They tend to be around teaching and community service and research. And many of those missions at U of A are really focused on industrial development, on resource development, because we are a resource development state. And the purpose of the talk here is to kind of bring home some of those stories and some of those narratives and describe what it is we do. But I want to start talking about students. So I ran through the numbers late last week trying to figure out how many students have graduated from the University of Alaska system with engineering or engineering-related science degrees, such as computer science. So there are two programs. There's University of Alaska Anchorage, University of Alaska Fairbanks that each have engineering schools. So I got the numbers down from UAA and UAF. Figured out that over the past decade, we have graduated over 2,700 degrees. We've conferred 2,700 degrees, either bachelor's, master's, or PhD degrees in engineering or computer science. So that's roughly 270 degrees per year. And over the course of the weekend, I was trying to put some context into that. What does that mean for the state of Alaska? So I looked up on the Department of Labor website and found out that the prediction is that for engineers and computer scientists, the prediction is that every year over the course of the next year, we're going to need approximately 600 new engineers or computer scientists in the state. So almost 600 people, almost 600 slots where we need, we're graduating about 270 per year. So even under those conditions, we're still not graduating half of the engineers and computer scientists that we need. And moreover, although many of our engineers and scientists stay in the state, I would say probably most of them stay in the state, not all of them do. So even those 270 people were graduating, we're still not contributing 270 people to the workforce. And that's important. And it's important to the industry, and it's important to the state. Reason being is because industry in Alaska wants Alaska-trained engineers. Alaska-trained engineers generally are people that grew up here, and they are certainly people that when they're going through their training at the University of Alaska, they are getting to know the state. They know that most of our resource development isn't indoors, it's outdoors. It's out where there's permafrost. It's out in the cold, remote environment. And our students at U of A are out there. That's our laboratory. That is where we're learning. So if you kind of look at the picture, here's one of our geological engineering professors with a group of students out there in the wilderness learning their trade. So yeah, there's a big advantage to industry to having students that are trained here in Alaska because we focus on it. And it's nothing, there's a lot of great schools out in the lower 48, and I don't, but what they don't do is they don't know about permafrost. They don't know about our conditions like we do. So we can train our students better. And more so, students that graduate from Alaska universities and go into the engineering workforce tend to stick around. So if a company invests in a new employee that came from Alaska that studied here, that employee is probably going to stick around. And that's important to industry. We hear that from our advisory boards all the time, that yes, we want Alaska-trained engineers. So there's a big advantage to us producing our own engineers.
Mr. Chairman?
Yep.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here, Doctor. You mentioned that, you know, roughly in a year there's 600 engineers needed annually, and that you're pushing about 270 a year. Why can't we get to the 600, or what are there mechanical issues? Is it a budget issue? Is it facility space issues? What's preventing you from getting 600 students?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, there's a lot of reasons. One is there's only so many students in the state of Alaska. There's a lot of capacity for us to grow, and we want to move towards that direction. One thing that actually it's really important to me, place for growth, is that we don't have very many female engineering students in our program. Nationwide, there's only 20% female engineering students in colleges across the nation. All right, well, gosh, a really great way for us to get more engineers into the workforce is to encourage young girls to get into engineering. So that's one place for growth. Yeah, that's.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Senator?
And I'm sorry if I missed this, but how many did you say women were in our programs?
In our programs, and I don't know the number for sure. I think it's 15, maybe 17%. It's lower than the national average.
All right. Thank you.
Yes.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I guess one thing, other thing I want to say about the engineering field in general is that engineering is a profession that people find fulfilling, Alaska students find fulfilling. It's a profession of kind of, if you're an engineer, you trade in the question of how to do things. And so the job of an engineer is to take kind of this vision, to see a need and then to visualize what needs to be built or constructed or developed from that, and go through the step-by-step process of creating that thing, whatever it is we're designing. That is a fairly compelling field to get into. So the engineers that we do train end up having fairly high-paying jobs, and it's a fulfilling career. So we only have so much time today. There's no way that I could actually go through all that we do, all that the University of Alaska provides with respect to engineering workforce, training, and so forth. And so I've listed essentially the programs that we offer in the colleges of engineering, as well as some of our workforce development programs. But those are just a fairly thin slice of everything that's related to resource development. So,
yep. Actually, I don't know if it's entirely fair, but I was going to give you an opportunity to respond to how these programs might be affected by, say, a 41% cut in the university budget. Obviously that's been proposed, and in real time we're going through budget, deliberating on that. And as a dean of the school, get your arms around that? And I recognize you got a board of regents, mm-hmm. and there's a whole raft of intermediaries, but would appreciate your insight.
Well, I appreciate the question, Mr. Chairman. A 41% budget cut would be devastating to the engineering college as well as, and I could probably speak for the university in general, mm-hmm. absolutely devastating. Mm-hmm. On the teaching side of the house in my college, virtually all of the funding that goes to us is in salaries. We no longer really have much money for travel or stuff or anything like that. It goes to people. And in the engineering college, it means programs. That's not to say that a 41% cut would be, divided equally all around. But, yeah, a 41% to our college would mean that we would provide 41% less service.
Thank you. Senator?
To that point, I had the university budget for 2 years, and my question is, has research been done on combining the three systems to one system rather than having a Fairbanks, Anchorage, and University of Anchorage combining it? It seems like that would save a ton of money. Also, when I had the budget, the president at that time said that the union contracts were driving up the university costs immensely, and also I know Eagle River campus is in the black, and it's because we use local buildings like the high school building. So I do think that I would – engineering is something you guys do great, and I would absolutely say – I know my husband has a degree from University of Fairbanks. And engineering is something that you do right, so I wouldn't want to hurt, the engineering program in general. But I do think, from a high level, that's something that you all can consider is trying to be innovative and find ways, because I think it's devastating to the states – spending between $14 and $16 billion out of our savings in the last 5 years. So,
thank you. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, absolutely. And I know that a few years ago we did look at that option of combining into a single university. And I won't speak about combining them all together. I can speak for the colleges of engineering, for instance. And what it would mean if the UAA College of Engineering and the UAF College of Engineering combined, there's still a lot of students in Anchorage and there's still a lot of students in Fairbanks. And for us, when we did the numbers, it didn't necessarily seem like we would save much, if any, money by combining into one school. Now, that's just at our unit level versus the whole college level. But it didn't necessarily pencil out because we still needed to have the same number of professors down there to meet their programs as well as the programs up here. Unless we were talking about just shutting down in one place or the other. A lot of the industry is in Anchorage, and a lot of those students want to stay there and do their work. A lot of the research and a fair amount of industry is in Fairbanks as well. So at least on the engineering side, it made sense to have them remain separate.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. Okay, so again, just a glimpse of some of the things that we're offering at the University of Alaska. And I wish that I had time to talk about them, but I don't. So I'll talk about just a few of the things that we're doing. I was a research director for several years, and we talk about research and what that means and why that's important. But and I think a lot of people, or I used to think this way, that research was just something that people at universities did, and then you wrote a paper and published it somewhere, and it gets put on a shelf in a journal in some library. In Alaska, that's actually not how it works. In Alaska, our research is very, very much tied to the goals of the state, and with for engineering, for example, we're really interested in development. So a lot of the research projects that we're doing is very closely tied to the goals of the state. And that helps out industry, for instance, because we're solving some of their challenging issues. But it also helps out the students for a number of reasons. One is because they are then working on the very problem. So in their college, they're working on the very problems that they're going to face when they're out there in the working world. You know, they're working on Alaska problems. And number two, it helps kind of get them integrated into the working world with industry, so that when they graduate, they tend to go work for those companies that they did research for. So it's a win-win all around. We've got a program at UAF that, well, we have the mining and the geological engineering programs that are in a single department. Mining engineering has been, UAF was a mining, the University of Alaska has been a mining school for 100 years. That's how we started. And so we still have a strong program in mining engineering. Right now we have about 65 students that are enrolled in the mining and geological engineering tracks. Almost all of them get jobs right at graduation. It's a pretty good deal for people that are interested in mining. And so...
Yeah, Dean?
Yes.
Dean Schnabel. Just had a question. In full disclosure, I am a graduate of the University of Alaska mining engineering program. And would you have a sense of starting salaries for, I just didn't have a good feel for a band for a newly minted engineer?
I will say this, Mr. Chairman. I was reading the notes from the mining department before this, and I saw the number $100,000 crop up. And I think I'd like to double-check that figure and give it to you. But I did see that number, $100,000, and it doesn't seem out of line that they would be making six figures very, very soon out of school. There's a high demand for, you know, it's the mining industry in general. Pays qualified people fairly well.
And then last, their University of Alaska and Southeast here has a program where they train, you know, technology training for the employment at Greens Creek or Kensington Underground.
Yes.
Are you affiliated with that, even though it's kind of on the technical side?
Yes.
How is that tied together?
We, as the University of Alaska, are affiliated with them. I don't have a lot of experience with them, but I do talk about them a little bit later on in the project. So yes, the University of Alaska is definitely affiliated with them.
Great. Thank you.
Absolutely. So with respect to mining, and this is true of petroleum as well, oftentimes industry is interested in having us do research and tackle some of their specific problems. So for instance, the reason they want to do that is because we're pretty good at doing experiments, at looking at a whole bunch of different scenarios, and it's nice if you can do that in a lab rather than doing that at a full-scale facility, because if you get it wrong in the lab, it's fine, and you don't want to mess up the full-scale facility. So universities, there is definitely a place for research with respect to optimizing processes. And when industry is having us do research for them, we're also, again, producing students that work there. So, for instance, we are working right now with Red Dog. And so I think last year, were talking to Red Dog about some of the problems that they're having, some of the challenges that they're having, and they decided, wow, I think we could probably get together and have your crew work on some of our challenges that we're facing. And one of those, and so we started a couple of projects just last year. We're 10 months into it. They're three-year projects. The first one is looking at Arctic mine water remediation. And so at the mine, you know, they've got these process waters and mine waters that go to the tailings pond. From the tailings pond, there's a treatment plant, and the water needs to be treated before anything is discharged because, you know, it's important to keep the environment clean. Well, those waters that are in around the tailings pond are generally high in dissolved solids, so they're high in dissolved metals and so forth. They're high in sulfate. And one of the things that is during the treatment train, one of the things that you want to do is try to remove as many of those metals from the water as possible. So the treatment plant is a physical chemical style treatment plant, but one thing that they could be doing that they're not is using biological treatment processes. And so there are sulfate reducing bacteria, which will take sulfate in the water and transform it to sulfite. And that's an anaerobic process, a process that happens in the absence of oxygen. That essentially what it will do is if you transform it to sulfide, then precipitate out some of the metals in the water. So essentially, we have bacteria that can help clean up the water. Those bacteria are generally found on site. They are cold weather bacteria. They work in low pH. We are working with Red Dog now to try to sample some of their bacteria on site, bring them back to the lab, and grow up the ones that do this most efficiently. And the hope is that we can get a culture of those going and actually make a treatment step out of this biological process and help improve the water quality of those tailings waters. And what that does is it saves the mine money because they don't have to work as hard in the other treatment steps. So using the bacteria that are on site, developing a treatment process is a great study for a university to do.
Oh, Senator?
Just a quick question. Is there any additional dangers to humans with all these anaerobic bacteria?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I think when we're working with any bacteria, it's important to be careful with respect to human health. And my gut answer is no, because those bacteria are already found on site, and they're grown anaerobically. But even when we're testing them, we would test for, are they dangerous to humans?
Thank you. And through the chair, just if you're doing much more massive quantities, it could be different, because anaerobic bacteria are pretty darn dangerous. Anyway, just wanted to, but it's a great innovation, I mean, to look at, so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. So another project we're doing with Red Dog is working to increase flotation yields. So I had to read up on flotation before this. But in mining, in the mining mill, flotation is a way that are used to kind of separate out what you want from what you don't want. And it's essentially you take the ore, you crush it up into powder, make a slurry out of it, and you put it in these big flotation tanks, and then you add some bubbles and maybe a few additives and agitate it a little bit, and some of the minerals will float and others won't. And so that's the way that they use to kind of concentrate their ores. Well, that flotation is highly dependent upon the chemistry of the ore. You know, how well something floats is dependent on the chemistry. And so as mines, as Red Dog and any mine is being developed, and you kind of go through that ore body, the chemistry changes. And so recently they've kind of noticed, gosh, we're getting lower in this pit and we're moving to a different pit and we're mixing them. And the chemistry of our ore is different now than it was when we were working with it before. And we would really like to try to figure out how to work with what we're seeing now to optimize our yield. Again, That involves looking at different slurry concentrations, different total dissolved solids, different processes within the flotation process. That is another great sort of study to be done at the university, and they've hired us to do, because we can try out all sorts of things, and we'll find some that work well and some that don't work well. But in the end, we're going to provide them with some hard data that will show, well, gosh, if you want to maximize your yield, use this process. So we're looking forward to that one. Mr. Chairman, you had asked about workforce development earlier, and we had a workforce development project a few years ago that we're just kind of wrapping up, and it was called the TACT Grant, and it was an interesting study. It was we work very closely with the Alaska Miners Association, for instance, and through our conversations with the Alaska Miners Association, they said, you know what we really need in the state, so we need mill process operators, we need mechanics, and we need underground miners and surface miner training. That's what we need. So we talked with the Department of Labor and found that there was this TACT program where we could provide some of those workforce development services while at the same time do some research. And we ended up doing that. We ended up putting together a mining mill operators program, and we had three sessions and provided occupational endorsements for, I think, 30 students. All of them were hired or immediately. We had five different mines that hired directly from that program. We had support for this TAC grant through the Center for Mine Training. And we also provided underground and surface miner training through the grant. So we were able to kind of organize a lot of this workforce development activity, as well as do some amount of research. And the research that we did was putting together this dynamic mill simulator. And so, you know, when you're learning to become a mill operator, of course, you can go in and into a mill and learn how everything works and learn the different flow rates and so forth, but wouldn't it be nice if you can first start by using a model to do that on computer to actually see how everything goes together? Well, we designed and developed the nation's only simulator that you can do this online. And actually, I went yesterday to mirl.uaf.edu and downloaded this simulator and started playing with it. I invite you to do so as well, because you can kind of download this simulator and see what happens when you change the different steps in the process of a mine mill. So it's kind of cool to do. That was tested by mines here in the state, and it's being used in the state. It's also being used internationally. So that was kind of a workforce development as well as research program that we put together based upon recommendations from the Alaska Miners Association. So, excuse me. We also have a petroleum engineering department in University of Alaska. Again, we're really focused on petroleum engineering in the state, but we also send a lot of our students out of state once they graduate. Most of our students graduate directly, find jobs right out of after graduation. We've got 65 students currently enrolled in the program. That program is important for a number of reasons. One is it produces engineers all across the state, but also a lot of our engineers are serving the legislature and serving the state government, helping to advise on issues of the day. And so, yeah, it's important that we have students that are engaged in their trade, in their as well as engaged in policymaking.
Dean Schnabel, you mentioned earlier some placement inside Alaska and outside of Alaska. Do you have a kind of a sense of, do, you know, a handful go out of state, or are they finding opportunities, work opportunities in Alaska as far as your graduate placement? When you say 98% of our graduates are placed in the oil and gas industry after graduation.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm not 100% sure on the answer to that question, because it changes. So, for instance, my sense is that most of our mining graduates stick around the state, whereas a higher fraction of our petroleum graduates go out of state. The petroleum industry in general tends to move their people around a lot, so someone may go out of state directly after graduation, and then a few years later they show back up again. But I can look at those numbers and find out for sure, and that's an important question. So I'll talk about a couple of our projects that are going on with our petroleum engineering. Heavy oil is, of course, a pretty important resource to the state of Alaska. There are something like 20 to 25 billion barrels of heavy oil stranded on the North Slope. Heavy oil is very viscous. It's hard to get out of the ground. It's thick. It doesn't want to get out. And so one thing we could do is try to heat it up and get it out. That would decrease the viscosity, make it easier to get out of the ground. But the problem up there on the North Slope, at least, is there's a lot of permafrost. And so we want to be careful about adding too much heat to the ground, because permafrost, if it thaws, is a problem. Something that people do elsewhere is add polymer and inject with polymer, flood with polymer, to get viscous oil out of the ground. And so if you can kind of envision a reservoir, and it's got, you know, rocks down there with lots of pore space in it and thick liquid, what a polymer will do when you flood with a water that's laced with polymer is it will kind of stick together and help to push that oil, that thick oil, through the ground, and can increase yields by 10% or so. Significantly increase those yields. Well, we really haven't tested polymer flood in really cold environments like here. And Hillcorp is very interested in doing that. And so through several conversations with Hillcorp, we decided, gosh, this would be something that would be very important to try. And so we partnered with them. Our petroleum engineering department, Hillcorp, partnered on a grant through the Department of Energy. And I just last year was awarded that grant. It was a $9 million grant, a pretty big deal, to test will polymer flooding work up on the North Slope to increase our yields. And those studies are now underway. We've got there's actually an injection well up at Milne Point, where we are doing the polymer flood, and we are collecting our influent and effluent data as we speak. We don't have results yet, but it's looking good. But that's an example of us actually working directly with industry and partnering and trying to solve a pretty important issue for the state of Alaska.
That would be interesting. It was a long chain polymer that they used along the pipeline at TAPS. They put a manifold downstream of each pump station and injected that, and they're taking up as a drag reducing agent, and they're taking up by the tanker load, and I think it allowed the pipeline to pump over 2 million barrels a day from a design capacity of 1.4 with that polymer material that was, you know, a lubricant basically on the inside of the. It's kind of interesting to see that might be rising again and having some benefit.
Thank you. This is another diagram of that project. I think it's out of order. Something that we are doing right now is forming the Energy Research Consortium of Alaska. And when I say we, I mean it's our engineering college, it's UAA, their engineering and science college, it's the Geophysical Institute, the International Arctic Research Center. So basically a lot of the different research entities across the university system have gotten together and said, wow, there are a lot of questions that in this instance the oil and gas industry needs answers to. But us as researchers, we need to hear from industry. And so we've invited a large group of industry representatives to get together and talk about, are there problems that pretty much everyone in industry really needs to see solved? A lot of times in industry, you know, you have a specific problem about a specific site. Well, they don't necessarily want to talk about that with everybody. But there are a number of problems out there that, gosh, everybody has the same problem. Could we work together to solve them through the power of research at the university? And the answer was yes. Industry was pretty interested in this. So we got together three times. The first time was in 2017, just as an initial meeting to say, hey, what are some of those real important problems that we think industry would like to work on together? And they came up with three themes. One was kind of coastal and offshore issues, ice on around drill rigs, that kind of thing. Another was changing permafrost with respect to oil production. And the third was subsurface imaging, using geophysics to image reservoirs and so forth. So those were three topics that the industry thought, yes, we'd like to see some joint university collaboration on. The second meeting was, after the first meeting, we kind of wrote up those themes and then came back with white papers and said, here's our themes. Does this still make sense? And they said yes. The third meeting, which happened just recently, late last year, was to kind of look at these different themes and come up with, if we were to do a project, let's actually put together a scope of work to get started. And if we were to pick one, what would it be? And what arose out of that is this oil and changing permafrost project. We've developed a scope of work through, again, there are folks involved from UAA and UAF, and there's a couple of the industry majors who are, you know, actually looking at this and deciding how do we get this project off the ground. But the project is about subsidence. And specifically, kind of if you look at the pictures, we've got hot liquids moving up through wellbores and moving down through wellbores. So we've got warm liquids moving through soils that need to be frozen. And in many instances, they're no longer frozen. So that permafrost that provides kind of the stable matrix for these wells is thawing. And that's a big problem all across the industry, because the wells are no longer kind of straight. They get bent and so forth. So what can we do to fix that problem? And we've been looking at that particular question for a while. So, for example, in that picture, that's a cell that we had down in one of our cold rooms, where we had a big block of soil, and we put some well risers down there, and then we actually look to see what happens, what kind of stresses and strains are felt on those risers as the soil thaws. I know a lot about that one because I actually had to go and clean that up after they were done, and it was a mess. But this question of how do we keep soil frozen, how do we build, how do we drill wells such that the soil will stay frozen as liquids are moving through them, how do we build pads and roads on the slope such that the permafrost doesn't thaw, is a huge issue. And there is nobody in the country more adept, that has more institutional knowledge about building on permafrost and just permafrost in general, than the University of Alaska. They're working with us because there is nobody else that knows how to do this. And it's pretty important. So that is still under consideration. This project is still under consideration. But frankly, it's going to go. This is something that needs to happen.
Senator?
I know this is an issue right now, you know, with the with some of the drilling going on. But the research funding considered by two major companies, can you drill down on that a little bit? Or is that something that's...
Through the chair, I'd rather not right now, because I was asking the principal investigator on this, you know, can I name names, can I talk about who's doing this? He said, you know what, I'd rather not until it's kind of written down and signed. They would just as soon leave that be.
Fair enough.
Some of the things that we're doing at the university. And again, another plug for university research is it can be somewhat aspirational. We can really look out a long way, and that's part of the training. So, for instance, coal resource in Alaska. Alaska has a lot of distributed coal resources. And that's great, but what do you do with a coal resource that's remote, maybe that's a roadless community or whatnot? One potential thing that could be done, and this is a ways out, but if we could take coal and make it into, use a coal gasifier to make syngas out of coal, we could take that syngas and run diesel generators off of syngas. Okay, and what that does, what that means, is that we could convert coal into a useful liquid fuel that could run on the infrastructure that's already in place in many, many rural Alaska communities. So, you know, in this kind of pie in the sky vision, if we can make syngas in communities, then potentially we could help power those communities without having to import diesel. And that would be fabulous if we could do it. Now the problem is, or the challenge is, that coal gasifiers are proven technologies on the gigawatt scale. Huge plants, works pretty well. But in rural Alaska communities, where that's the kilowatt scale, maybe. So that's much, much smaller. So getting from these technologies that work great on the gigawatt scale down to the kilowatt scale is no mean feat. At UAF, we are currently working on a project funded by Department of Energy to look at a coal gas fire on the megawatt scale. 10, 15 megawatts, about that size. And even then, it's not a proven technology. But we're near the end of a front-end engineering and design study to look at, would a coal gasifier work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks? The Department of Energy has some potential funding for this thing if we think it's going to work. And what that means is, say, we take that, we've got the old power plant and the new power plant. We've got room in the old power plant. If we brought a coal gasifier there, we could use used-to-belly coal, convert that into syngas, and then fire that into, we have a large generator on campus that hasn't really been used, and make power. One thing that would accomplish is it would kind of prove that technology on the megawatt scale, which is a step down from the gigawatt scale, and demonstrate that, yes, this does work, which is a step closer to that kilowatt scale, right? Another thing interesting, at least in Fairbanks, is it could really help our kind of energy equation, because coal gasification is a fairly efficient process, and efficiency in power generation means that the air emissions are better. I've got a chart here, and essentially right now we are using a turbine to follow wind power, to regulate wind power. Okay, so, and if you look at the red line here is the turbine efficiencies, and the blue line is the efficiencies of a regular generator. And so if we could use a piston-driven generator to follow wind instead of a turbine, we could operate in the more efficient zone. Because when wind is happening, when we're getting a lot of wind, your generator's not running very quickly. Okay, so we're down in kind of the 5-megawatt zone, which is inefficient for a turbine, but efficient for a generator, for a regular generator. Now, all that to say is that we have the generator, we have the fuel supply from Usabelli, we could use coal, and with the gasifier, we could actually run our generator and use this to follow wind. Again, kind of pie in the sky, but that is potentially feasible. So a lot of questions to work out before we get there, but we're working on it. And at least right now, it seems like this could potentially work. Almost finished. I don't want to finish, though, without putting in a plug for our workforce development through the University of Alaska. We've trained over 1,500 workers in the oil and gas industry through the Mining and Petroleum Training Service, through the Process Industries Careers Consortium. We've got the facility at UAS. Engineering workforce development. I've talked a lot about some of the things that we're doing at the level of bachelor's and master's and PhD, but engineering workforce development you have to go the whole gamut. People at the associate's level, occupational endorsements. If Alaska is going to have a fully trained engineering and engineering-related workforce, we need to support all throughout.
Could you briefly address the importance or the role that community colleges might serve in kind of producing an oil and gas workforce? I mean, do you integrate it at that level? Valdez, Kenai, Slobodna, so forth. I mean, are you tied in at that level, or where do you cross connect?
I can, Mr. Chairman, and for that I'm going to scoot back on our slides a little bit. Back to some of these programs that we're offering. So for instance, the ones listed, occupational safety and health, those are associates of science, occupational endorsements. So absolutely, we do that through the community college system as well as the university system-wide.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Good. Great question.
Senator?
I love your last slide where it says a strong engineering workforce is critical to Alaska's economic future. Engineers are some of my favorite people in the world. My father was an electrical engineer. My husband's an engineer. Both my boys are engineers. Where my problem is with the Common Core math. And sadly, under President Gamble, we aligned our standards, our math standards, to the Common Core new math. And a professor at Stanford said it's the most detrimental thing possible to creating engineers. And less than 2% of students have a potential under this math system. Does that bring concern? I love the engineering programs. I really want engineers to come out. I've got lots of nieces and nephews in the program, but I'm very, very there. Most of them are homeschooled, but I'm really concerned about the math program being a detriment. Saxon math was so much better than this new math. Anyway, I don't know if you want to make a comment or not on that.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Reinbold. I'm not that familiar with the Common Core math and what it was before that. I can say that you're absolutely right. Math is critical to a successful engineer. I will say that our engineers that we are bringing into the program, some of them have trouble with math, some don't. The ones that end up graduating all get through our math program.
Through the chair. I think it's just absolutely critical, just like reading proficiency at age third grade is critical for some of the language arts and things like that, but having a really, really excellent math is critical to success for allowing engineering. It's something I'd highly encourage you to look, before there aren't enough people that are qualified in the math because of this terrible math program, but it was Saxon math that we had before. Yeah, it was Spalding English and Saxon math, and I wish we would go back to it because they were really good programs, and we produced some pretty great engineers in this state. But I'm really concerned about the future of engineering in Alaska, and that's why I think looking at the math program early, we're 51st out of 52 in some of the qualifications, and that's why I think don't overlook it. It's something we can prevent and change right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dean Schnabel, any other comments? I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for traveling here and sharing this with us. It's exciting. It's exciting to see that we've got some progress being made and engineers being graduated. And I don't think that statistic of the number of women in the engineering schools changed much, because I remember every single woman that was in the engineering program when I was there, and it wasn't very many. But thank you very much for for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. Yeah. I want to say one thing as with respect to math and young girls, actually, is something uplifting. I was in the office this weekend, and they were having a math counts competition, and there were so they were middle school aged kids, and they were all there having math competitions. About half of them were girls, and they were really, really excited to be good at math and to move forward.
Great news.
Yeah,
great.
That's our future.
Good. Thanks again. I would note that our next committee meeting will be held at 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, February 20th, when we'll take up Senate Bill 43 to extend Big Game Commercial Services Board. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 4:20 p.m. Thank you.